Okay, Tov, Chodesh Tov. So before we get to the subject at hand, there is a dispute amongst the great poskim as to whether Misha Nichnas Adar Marbim B'Simcha is relevant for the first Adar when there are two Adarim. So in the yeshiva high schools, they paskin l'chumra that it is. So today in some yeshivot, there's already Misha, Misha, Misha going on, which is a nightmare for school administrators. Unless you do what we did in Hashmonaim, is beat the kids to their game and bring them into the picture 2 months before and have them organized nicely with some supervision above them. And if you give them responsibility, it usually works out okay. And you handpick the guys, the kids who are going to run it, and then it becomes a very nice, an educational and fun activity. I can tell you what the kids in Chashmonaim would do, and I think they're still doing it, but it started in my tenure there. They would invite orphanages, batei yitomim from various cities, including Yerushalayim, to come to Chashmonaim and spend a day at the yeshiva in a type of carnival. And this was the way they had all kinds of programs and music programs and games and contests and whatnot. And the kids in the yeshiva were entrusted with just making sure that these kids had smiles on their faces from morning to evening. And that's how they would fulfill Misha Nichnas Adar Marbim B'Simcha. It was quite an educational experience and it was a lot of fun for everybody. No property was damaged in the buildings of the yeshiva. Nobody lost sleep over this. And their kids realized that's the way to do it. And so you just have to just be a step ahead of the game and not wait for the kids to puncture the tires of all the ramim and do all kinds of stupid things, like take all the furniture out of the Beit Midrash and put it to a laboratory, buy a physics laboratory into the Beit Midrash, and then of course the whole school is topsy-turvy, and they think this is a big mitzvah of a nafohu, but you have to be a little bit smarter. Sometimes adults aren't smarter than kids, but you just have to force yourself and be a little smarter. The issue, I spoke about Pei Shabbat, was all sheer, whether you view the two Adarim, Adar Rishon, Adar Sheni, as both being essentially Adar, but it splits into two, just like we have Rosh Hashanah, Yom Arichta, long day. 2 days Rosh Hashanah, halachically, is like 1 48-hour day. So here you have a 60-day month, if you can just imagine something like that. So the first Adar also has significance vis-a-vis Purim. And that's why we have Purim Katan, and there are certain halachot in 2 weeks' time for Yudalit and Tedvav Adar Rishon, that we don't say Tachnun, there's no Hespedim, there's no fasting. There are things that we don't do. There's a certain measure of Simcha on a low level, a low profile type of Purim. We don't perform the positive mitzvot, but the negatives are enforced even for Purim Katan. The other opinion is to see Adar Rishon as simply an extra month, and for whatever reason, they just gave it the nickname Adar Rishon, but it's not really Adar at all. The main Adar is the second Adar, and it's the only Adar, and the first month is just an add-on to the calendar for the purpose of a leap year, and hence, according to that second opinion, there's no such animal called Purim Katan. It doesn't exist, and that is a basic machloket, and as a corollary, so does Misha Nichnas Adar Marbim B'Simcha kick in for Adar Rishon or not? Well, it depends on this machloket, whether Adar Rishon is an integral part of Adar Sheni, like part one of part one and two, or is it just another month, like Kislev and Shvat and Tevet and so on. And that's why I say this basic issue it triggers a whole discussion about the yard sites and Adar Rishon, Adar Sheni, when the person passed away in a regular year, or Bar Mitzvah, Bat Mitzvah, when to do it. That makes for good shiurim in the shuls and Bar Mitzvah speeches and so on. Okay. Today we're going to deal with the issue from slavery to redemption. I know we've already sitting on Sefer Shmot for 2 weeks. Last week we did the Gimgum, the stuttering of Moshe Rabbeinu, the difference between Kvateh and Aral Svatayim. And the last thing we did, although we didn't spend a lot of time on it, was a section of the Zohar that the Rav brought in one of his articles on Tfilah, Gula Tfilah, and Talmud Torah, where he shows that there were really three stages. Stage one is when Am Yisrael just was so, anesthetized, they were anesthetized. They were without any sensation whatsoever. There was no sound coming out of them. They were just voiceless, totally voiceless. That was one stage when a slave realizes there's just nothing to scream about anymore because there's nobody on the other end listening. So therefore, it's just they become insensitive to the whole issue of time. That's one, and we're going to elaborate on this today. The second stage is when there's at least a shriek, even though it may not be able to be articulated properly, but there's a shriek at the and a shriek is similar to an animal shriek, but at least there's on some level some type of reaction to what's going on in protest. And of course, finally, there's voice, where there's word, not just voice, but there's word, where there's articulation. And the Rav felt that these three stages existed with Am Yisrael Mitzrayim. Before Moshe Rabbeinu's arrival, they were without voice completely. Moshe Rabbeinu came, there was an intermediary stage of voice without word, and then finally we got to Har Sinai, it became voice with word. And that was really the tail end of last week's Shi'ur. We pointed out that the sequence in the Siddur is that there's Geula, Baruch Atah Hashem Gaal Yisrael, and immediately, without any hefsek, we begin Tefillah, that it moves into the redemption moves into the idea of word, and word on its highest level is Talmud Torah, and that's why there's Kriyat HaTorah as part of the davening experience. It's not that Chazal said, you know what, we should read the Torah three times a week, at least, Monday, Thursday, and Shabbat, but, you know, pull everybody together at 2 p.m. That's not the case. Kriyat HaTorah is an integral part of Tefillah. The Rambam talks about Kriyat HaTorah not in the context of Hilchot Talmud Torah, but in the context of Hilchot Tefillah. And it's not only because of pragmatics, that's what happens in the Siddur after Shmoneh Esrei and Tachnun, you take out the Sefer Torah. But the fact that we say Kaddish with Titkabel Tzloton Uvoton after Kriyat HaTorah in a weekday setting, and even though on Shabbat we've said the Titkabel after Shacharit before we take the Sefer Torah out, that's because we're going to daven Musaf. And there's going to be a musaf with a kaddish with titkabel, exactly what we did yesterday and today, a Rosh Chodesh. So there's always a kaddish with titkabel that follows Kriyat HaTorah in every sense, in every single scenario of Kriyat HaTorah. So there's something about Kabbalah that we ask Kadosh Baruch Hu to receive out tefillot. So part of that package is the fact that Am Yisrael has upgraded to the idea of voice with word. It's a Kabbalistic idea. It's also indicative of the fact that the Rav was keenly aware of the world of Kabbalah. He wasn't a mekubal. A mekubal is a phrase which means he was an active Kabbalist. The Rav wasn't into that, certainly not into practical Kabbalah, that, you know, if somebody's sick, so, you know, you do this and that, and all of a sudden you're going to get healthy. The Rav was the last thing in the world. But the Rav was aware of the text of the Kabbalah, and insofar as Chabad, where the principal text is the Tanya that was authored by the first Rebbe of Chabad, Shnei Zalman of Liadi. So this was the first attempt to take the sophisticated Kabbalah and bring it down to layman's reading. The Tanya was written for Balabatim. It wasn't written for Kabbalists. It was written for every single person. And if you're a devout Chabad Chassid, you study Tanya every single day along with Chumash and Rashi. And that's part of your reading. When the Rav was a child in the Cheder in Chasilovich, where his Malamed was a Chabadnik, so he knew more verses out of the Tanya by heart than he did other things, which triggered his grandfather Rav Chaim, the famous Rav from Brisk, to tell his son Rav Moshe, the Rav's father, get him out of that Cheder fast and homeschool him. You know, the Rav was never attended a yeshiva in his life. That's why he didn't go sour. You know, that's why he was okay. This is a lohit kalkel. You know, Rabbi Mital Zichron of the Bracha used to tell us, you send the kids to the school that's going to do the least damage. So in education, we're into damage control. That's what we do. In case you were wondering what we do in school. But the Rav was not in any yeshiva at all, at all. First time he was in any formal education was he went to university. Without university training, basically, he was already admitted to a doctoral program in Berlin, although he did have a short tenure at the Polish University in Warsaw. But nothing came out of that. But the Rav was aware of the source of Kabbalah, and it was not infrequent that he would even quote, you know, whole passages from the Zohar, as he does in the case of the dealing with the stuttering of Moshe Rabbeinu, and that section of the Zohar really becomes a very, very important piece of the understanding of what happens to Moshe Rabbeinu. And in that case, we discussed last week The Moshe Rabbeinu's Aral Sfatayim, the stuttering, so there may have been a physical speech impediment, but that was the Kvat Peh that was discussed in Parshat Shmot, when Moshe stood next to the Sneh, the burning bush. But in Parshat Va'era, we repeat something about a speech issue, it's not Kvat Peh, it's Aral Sfatayim. So that's why we explain that it could be that it came back to the whole issue of Moshe Rabbeinu not being convinced that the Bnei Yisrael deserved redemption, and a person who's a leader who's not convinced that of the case cannot make a convincing argument, cannot get up there and speak positively to Paro. And I gave certain examples of this, and that may have been the issue. And to that end, we're going to open up today. Well, there's a concept called Hester Panim. Hester Panim means that God's awareness in this world is been blocked. God's in hiding. This very much relates to the month of Adar, because the Gemara takes the pasuk in Parshat Vayelech, which I have from source number one. So let's just read the first these pasukim from Parshat Vayelech, Dvarim Parak Lamed Aleph, that almost defines what Hester Panim is all about. Vayom Hashem al Moshe, Hincha Shochev Mavatecha. Kadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe that he's going to pass away, going to die. V'kama am hazeh v'zana achrei Elohei nechar ha'aretz asher hu b'shama b'kirbo v'azavani v'eferet briti asher karati ito. Wonderful, beautiful words to tell Moshe Rabbeinu right before his demise. He says, by the way, the people are going to sour, they're going to leave me, they're going to serve for idols. I mean, you know, you figure, just let Moshe Rabbeinu die. What happens, happens. No, he's got to go to his death, knowing that everything he attempted to do in 40 years is all going to go down the tubes once they go into Mitzrayim, into Eretz Canaan, and they're really not going to follow. It's very encouraging. V'chara api bo bayom hahu v'azavtim. Kadosh Baruch Hu says, I will express my anger, and how will this be expressed? V'azavtim, I will leave the people. V'starti panai mehem, and I will cause my, the English translations are countenance with my face, as if to say my presence will not be made aware. V'yal le'echol umtza'uhu ra'ot rabot v'tzarot. V'amar v'yomahu, halo, ki alken ein Elohai b'kirbi, mitza'uni ha'ra'ot ha'ele. People are going to say, oh, you know, all my misfortunes are because there's no God around. Why is there no God around? Because Kadosh Baruch Hu decided not to be around. V'anochi haster astir panai. I will hide my face. Bayomahu al kol ha'ra'a she'asa ki pana el Elohim acherim. You have turned to idols, to foreign gods, foreign deities. So haster panim is the opposite of ri'iyat panim. Where do you see ri'iyat panim? You see it in the context of Shalosh Regalim, Yeira'e Kol Zchurcha Pnei Hashem Elokecha. Riyat Panim means being in the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We sometimes use the words Gilui Shechina, God's presence is being revealed, but it's known as Riyat Panim. Moshe Rabbeinu wanted an absolute Riyat Panim and is denied. He says, Kadosh Baruch Hu tells him, Parshat Kitisa, V'ra'ita et achorai ufanai lo yeirau. My face, the essence of what a Kadosh Baruch Hu is, you'll never see. Ki lo yir'ani ha'adam v'chai. A human being is not capable of fully appreciating what a Kadosh Baruch Hu is. But something from the rare, you'll get a glimpse. You'll know more than anybody else. Like sometimes you see a person, and you see the person from the back, and you're guessing who it might be. Sometimes you're right. By the way the person walks, by the width color of the hair, by the hat the person's wearing, whatever it is. There are all kinds of identifying features from the rear that you might be able to make a good guess, and in all likelihood you might even be right. But sometimes you're dead wrong, right? You happen, you go over and you say, you know, hi Moshe. It's not Moshe. Oh, sorry. It's happened to me. You swear that that's the person, you know? You just didn't see his face yet. And when the person turns around, you know, oh, I didn't know you did a facial operation. But Riyat Panim is that ability. So Kadosh Baruch Hu says that human beings won't be able to see it, but that doesn't mean that Kadosh Baruch Hu won't be doing it. So Riyat Panim means that Kadosh Baruch Hu is making himself available to Am Yisrael. Hester Panim is the exact opposite. Kadosh Baruch Hu is not available. Doesn't mean he's not there, He's not available for Am Yisrael. You know, people have asked the question, you know, where was God in the Shoah? So of course, others have asked, where was man? Don't ask where was God. Where was man? You know, what are you bothering Kadosh Baruch Hu? The fact that a Kadosh Baruch Hu was behester panim, and it's not my guess, it was a language that was used by the Rav in his classic speech on Yom HaTzma'ut at Yeshiva University in 1956, Tavshin Tet Zayin, which became his classic article, Kol Dodi Dofek, which is a phrase out of Shir HaShirim. He hears the knockings, and the Rav hears six knockings 8 years after the State of Israel was established, and he gives some type of theological connection to the Shoah and the establishment of Medinat Yisrael, that the 2.5 years that passed from the end of World War II and the end of the Shoah and Kum HaMdina, it's, you know, in history, that's a snap in the finger. When what's 2.5 years? It's nothing. So the Rav felt this is not a historic accident at all, but is clearly a direct result. Of course, you can explain this on a political science manner as well, the relationship between the Shoah and Kum HaMdina, and that's why the Palestinians are into Holocaust denial. I mean, the head of the Palestinian Authority, Abu Mazen, Abbas, he got his doctoral dissertation in Moscow University on Holocaust denial. I mean, that's basically an official line, because if you deny the Holocaust never took place, so then there's no basis for the decisions at the United Nations to establish Medinat Yisrael, that everything collapses. And if you clean out under Har Bayit and have no remnant whatsoever that there even was once a Beit HaMikdash, so then you come out and say there was never a Beit HaMikdash, and Am Yisrael has no claim to Har Bayit. I mean, these are, you know, cheap shots that they do use, but there are people in the world who buy it for political expediency. We know that. This is part of the Olam Goylam. You know, the world is willing to accept these things. And we have to constantly fortify. And sometimes it sinks into our own psyche. You know, maybe they're right. You know, like, you know, if it's CNN, they say it. You know, it must be Torah Moshe. And it's you got to be careful of these things. So Hester Panim, the Kadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe Rabbeinu, this is going to happen. So the Gemara says in Masechet Chulin, Daf Kuf Lametet, Esther Min HaTorah Minayin. Is there an indication, a remez, to the Esther, the Purim story, in the Torah itself? Knowing fully well the Purim story has occurs 1,000 years after the Torah. So the answer is yes. And it cites this pasuk, Vanochi Haster Astir Panai. So if you look at the word Astir, Aleph Samach Taf Yud Resh, you have the letters of Esther. Aleph Samach Taf Resh, which her Hebrew name was Hadassah. I mean, that says clearly in the Megillah. Her name was Hadassah, but she had a Persian name. And this already, let me just sidetrack for a second. Let me try to remember where I was. So I get back to it. you know, we have this, whether it's right or wrong, I'm not going to be judgmental here, but there are people in Chutz La'aretz who are given a name at birth, at the brit, let's say, or at a kiddush for a girl, but they have an English name, they have a secular name, which is not the translation of Aaron, Aaron, Yosef, Joseph, or something like that. You know, Moshe, you know, Mori. What does Mori have to do with Moshe? Sado, Maris. They'll give a name. They won't call him Moses. Moses, you have today athletes. Black. But you have black Muslims. They have Moses, Jethro Pugh. Remember that? You know, they have all kinds of interesting biblical names. I had a friend whose name was Ezra, but that wasn't his Hebrew name. That was his English name. He was Yisrael Shloima. He had a different name. People have that. This was done. And thank God my parents didn't do that. And all the English names were basically Hebrew names, just with given the English spelling and so on. But, you know, Chazal said that Mitzrayim, one of the three things that B'nai Yisrael kept, that kept them going as an identifiable people, they didn't change their names to Egyptian names. So it's interesting that Moshe has an Egyptian name. Moshe's name is Egyptian. Who called him Moshe? Bat Paro. Bat Paro. What, she didn't go to the Hebrew dictionary and look up Hebrew names for Brit? No. He was probably had it, and he was 3 months old already when he's called Moshe. So he had a name. So Chazal said, maybe his name was Tuvia. That's a nice name. Vayar Ki Tovu, when he was born, it says Vayar Ki Tovu. So there's a whole slew of Midrashim. What does it mean? It was good. So one said he was born circumcised already, Mahul. One says the house lit up with light. It was indication, wow, somebody special was just born. And one says his name was Tuvia. I mean, he had a Hebrew name. So Chazal understood that he must have had a name. Yeah.
He slept through the night, right away. That's why he was.
That's why he was Tovia. Chazal actually say that one of the reasons that he was, that it says Vayarki Tovhu, that he was born more mature than the average infant, newborn. You know, you can tell a newborn. You can tell a newborn, you can tell a baby that's 2 months old already. Even though a baby 2 months old could be as heavy or as light as a newborn, right? Depends what the starting point was. No question about it. But you see, there's more development and so on. But Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't like that. He was born and there was something already that made him look a little bit special, a little older. But one view is that his name was Tuvia, but he's called Moshe. And this is going to be very important, that Moshe carries a foreign name. A foreign name. And there was even a suggestion made that when it was said about the Rambam, Mi Moshe ad Moshe, Lo kam ki Moshe, which is very famous, and the Rav son-in-law of Professor Yitzhak Tversky, Zichron Lebracha, from Harvard, who wrote this great big book on the Rambam, Introduction to the Mishnah Torah of the Rambam, writes his last article of his life about the appreciation of the Rambam shortly after the Rambam dies. They're already saying, Mi Moshe ad Moshe, Lo kam ki Moshe. Didn't take 500 years to view the Rambam as an iconic, superhuman type of figure. To say Mi Moshe ad Moshe lo kam ke Moshe is not something you just say about anybody. So one of the Achronim, I don't remember which one, makes a comment and says, you know what this means? That if you take a look in the Gemara, the Mishnah in the Gemara, you won't find one personality in the Chazal whose name is Moshe. And it eclipsed this great Gadol saying that until the day of the Rambam, nobody called their children by the name Moshe. It happens not to be true, because we happen to know that in the days of the Gaonim, there was a Rav Moshe Gaon, one of the Rashi Yeshiva in Bavel, in Baghdad. So we know that. We know, we even have some of his writings. But that's what happens if you say what you say in the 17th or 18th century, and you're not equipped with the material that we have today, from all the Gneza material, and that which took place in the days of the Gaonim, from the year 500 to the year 1000, So today we're a little bit smarter. We know that that's a wonderful idea. Mi Moshe ad Moshe lo kam ki Moshe. That nobody called their babies Moshe until the Rambam. It happens not to be true, but it's a wonderful idea. But that's not what it means. Mi Moshe ad Moshe lo kam ki Moshe at all. But I say this because it's clear that the name Moshe was a rare name, and certainly it was not used in the days of the Mishnah and the Gemara by any of the Chachamim. And that's strange that nobody carries the name of Moshe. The other biblical names are there. Yeah, Bakra.
Among the Haredim, it still isn't a popular name.
What, Moshe? I don't know. I don't know why. It was one of the Satmar Rebbes was Moshe Teitelbaum. No, the Moshe Teitelbaum was the nephew of the Satmar Rebbe, and he became the next Satmar Rebbe before it split. But no, Moshe is used, and great Chazanim by the name of Moshe, like Moshe Kozovitsky. Sure. No. Moshe today is a popular name, right? This next month will be the Yahrzeit from Rav Moshe Feinstein, and he was born, by the way, on the 7th of Adar. That's why they called him Moshe. He died on the 13th of Adar Sheni, so that's why his Yahrzeit is going to be in Adar Sheni, not in Adar Rishon, because he died in a leap year 30 years ago. And I have a son whose name is Eitan Moshe, who was born 30 years ago, exactly the day Rav Moshe passed away, so we tacked on the name at the Brit. So we should have a zeche to Rav Moshe Feinstein and our family. And when I saw Rav Moshe's daughter, Rebbitzin Tendler, Leah Shalom, I told her, I said, you know, I have a son who carries your father's name, albeit a second name, but he's, you know, it's there. But there's only one problem. I knew Rav Moshe, and Rav Moshe was very calm and very subdued. I said, my son's a shovav. I mean, my son's a wild. So she says, I met her 15 years ago. My son was then 15 years ago in high school. So she says, give him time, he'll calm down. So I can tell you that the bracha was mekuyam halfway. He has calmed down somewhat, but we're not interested that he should calm down legamre, because that's him, that's his personality. Okay, so this is this hester panim. I get back to it now. Moshe Rabbeinu indeed carried a foreign name. We're going to see how this is relevant to the whole discussion about what Hester Panim is. And with regard to Purim, so Chazal say, Ester min ha-Torah minayin, v'nochi Hester astir panai, that it's a takeoff on the word Ester, And she has this Persian name, but it really reflects on the pasuk, "Vanuchi Aster Astir Panai." Go through the beginning to the end of Megillat Esther, and you're not going to find God's name. The whole story is there without Hashem's name. The whole Sefer in Tanakh, Hashem's name is not there. Beremez, there's a Rashi Tevot, Yavo Hamelech VeHaman Hayom, spells out Yud Hey Vav and Hey Shem Hashem. So you have this. And there's certain artistic Megillot where I've seen this, where the artist covered the Yud and the Hey and the Vav and the Hey with gold. In other words, it's written in black, but then there's gold plated on top of the Yud Kei Vav Kei, and I take issue with doing that for two reasons. First of all, halachically, it might be a problem of Ktav Agabe Ktav. It may be possible. It may disqualify the Megillah by just doing that. And the second is, if the whole purpose was to camouflage Hashem's name by writing the Yud, Hey, Vav, and the Hey in gold, what you've done is you've amplified it. You've made it come to life. It's boleh. It's very outstanding. That's the exact opposite of what the understanding should be. It should be hidden. So why is the Kadosh Baruch Hu's name hidden? Because you can read the Megillah as a storybook. The Gemara says, Megillah nikret igeret v'nikret sefer. Masav Megillah yutet. So Megillah is called a letter. The Rav said, you know what a letter is? A newspaper. It's a newspaper. Well, today it's important, and tomorrow you wrap fish with it, right? What do you do with the newspaper of yesterday? You throw it out. There's no value whatsoever. Which means you can read Megillat Esther, it's today's story, and that's it, and they're finished. Or, it's a sefer. Sefer by us doesn't mean a book. It means part of Kitvei HaKodesh. It means it has a message for eternity. And Chazal say that, Kol HaSfarim Atidim Libatel, all the relevance of all the Sifrei Nevi'im are going to become irrelevant, days of Yom HaMashiach. Mashiach. Chutz Megillat Esther. Shenemar v'zichram lo yosuf mizaram. You're going to keep reading the Megillah even in Yemot HaMashiach. There's a story to be told. There's a message to be derived. And so it's a sefer. It's clearly a sefer. But it's an igaret. You don't want to see it as a sefer. And the Rav applied this, by the way, to Medinat Yisrael. You want to read the story of Medinat Yisrael as a history book, as a continuum of newspaper reports for 67 years? Bakasha. Or you can see it as a sefer. Depends how what glasses you're reading. You have long range, you have short range, nearsighted, farsighted. Depends what glasses you're reading. The story of Medinat Yisrael. It says, remember the Rav explained the pasuk of with regard to Balaylahu Nadadash Natamelech. So Rashi says Malko Shel Olam. That wasn't Achashverosh. It was a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Who didn't sleep well that night? Achashverosh couldn't sleep well that night. So go to the pharmacy. There are plenty of pharmaceutical solutions on the shelf there for people who have insomnia. You know, there's a beseda. If you don't want to take a pill, go to somebody's shir. It usually works. But that's the whole business. But I knew Nadash Natamela couldn't sleep. So they had to have the Sefer Zichronot read with him. So Chazal said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wasn't sleeping. Because if Am Yisrael, if there's a gzera, Lashmid, Larog, Ulabed, et kol ha-yudim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not sleeping that night. That's reading the Megillah with a different take. Seeing it as a sefer, not as an igeret. You can read it both ways. Legitimate to read it both ways. Take your pick. Which Megillah do you want? The igeret or the sefer? So the Hester Panim means Kadosh Baruch Hu is just in the background. The believing Jew knows that Kadosh Baruch Hu is in the background. That's why we say Shasani Sim Lavotenu by Amim Bahem Bazmanazeh on Purim no less than on Hanukkah. Because Kadosh Baruch Hu was there. But it wasn't evident. But we believe he was there. Hester Minatar Minayin, there was a period of Hester Panim. But the Rav said a big chidush here, something very novel. That Hester Panim, which is a category usually associated with the relationship between a Kadosh Baruch Hu and Am Yisrael, or lack of relationship, as he referred to in that great speech, Kol Tadi Dofek, as Hester Panim Mukhlat, absolute Hester Panim, in the days of the Shoah. So the Rav felt that there could be Hester Panim vis-a-vis a Jew in his relationship to Am Yisrael. A Jew can detach himself or herself from Klal Yisrael. And I'll give you the word in the Pasuk where it spells it out, even though in its halachic context it means something else. V'nichrita ha-nefesh ahi me'ameha. What is karet? What does it mean, v'nichrita ha-nefesh ahi me'ameha? That this person's soul is going to be cut off from the people. So the concept of karet is debatable. Most of the Rishonim, based on the Gemara, suggest that it means a person will die below the age of 60. And that's why the Gemara says that great Tanaim and Amoraim made birthday parties at age 60. And that's why great Hasidic Rebbes would celebrate their 60th birthday, indicating that they obviously didn't do anything that they were warranted in Onesh Karet. And now every day after age 60 is a blessing. It's just it's bonus time until 120. So 60 years, you get your 60 years. If you didn't get your 60 years, something went wrong, and of a karet nature. The Rambam doesn't buy that. The Rambam says that karet means the loss of olam haba, no matter when a person dies, at age 3 or at age 95. Olam haba is something that you want to hang on to. You're born Jewish, you have a chelek. Kol yisrael yesh lahem chelek olam haba. You can lose it. You don't want to do that. Loss of olam haba is called karet. Rambam explains it in the 8th chapter of the Hilchot Teshuvah. So that's a different take on what karet is. But on a national level, v'nichrata nefesh yimei ameha means severing the ties from the people. When the Lubavitcher Rebbe, towards the end of his life, spoke about the Jews in the United States of America, he referred to the 3 million Jews in America. And people looked at him like, one second, did he lose his statistics? I mean, the machloket is whether there's 4.2 million, whether there's 5 million, whether there's 5.5 million, whether there's 6 million. The Pew report, of course, who do you define as a Jew? But nobody says 3 million. Nobody says 3 million. I mean, people will say that you can use 3 million Jews who are synagogue affiliated. That includes 500,000 affiliated with Orthodox shuls. There are about 500,000 Shomrei Torah mitzvot on whatever level you define it in the United States. About 10% of the Jewish population in the United States is Shomrei Torah mitzvot. And then you have another million something point whatever members of conservative shuls, another million or so members of reform shuls. I mean, from an Israeli point of view, these are Chiloni Jews. I mean, they may call themselves Mesorati, but how Mesorati is it to drive to shul on Shabbos? That's not Mesorat. That's called Chil Shabbos. So I will agree with a statement that was made by Rabbi Emanuel Rachman Zichron Lebracha, who got into a lot of trouble for it, but I agreed with him wholeheartedly, and I don't take it back, that the conservative reform movement did serve for some people as the last stand before falling off the cliff and total assimilation. And no small number of people who were affiliated with those two movements, albeit deviant from a halachic point of view, found their way back to Torah Judaism. And if not for the existence of those movements, they would have been lost. So I think it would be kafui tova, it would be wrong, completely wrong, to totally write it off. And I'm very, very careful about that. And I think from the point of view of Ahavat Yisrael, you also have to be very careful, that because the Rambam expressed Ahavat Yisrael also to the Karaites. So you have to love Jews as Jews. And while we're so perfect, hold on. Before you start judging the next person, first look in the mirror and see how perfect you are before you start writing off other Jews. But the Rebbe wrote off 3 million Jews. Said only 3 million Jews. Why? Because beyond synagogue affiliation, who else is there? According to the minimalist 4.2 million Jews in the United States, where does that come from? It comes from people who are on the mailing list for the federations and the United Jewish Appeals and stuff like that, that we call the Schnorr mail. So there are people who are not affiliated with any of the shuls, but they're affiliated with Jewish organizations on some level, which means that they get a calendar on Erev Rosh Hashanah somewhere with an envelope, and they even return the envelope with a check. So that's another 1.5 million Jews. It's a lot of people. But there are more Jews in America than not even there. They're not even there. So where are they? The answer is v'nichrita nefesh ahi me'ameha. They've completely severed their ties. And to that end, the Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote them off. He wrote them off. It's a very painful statement. Very painful statement. We need to write off Jews. But they wrote themselves off, essentially. They're just not part of. They're not part of the action of Klal Yisrael in any way or manner. Any way or manner. Not going to comment about Bernie Sanders, and all I can tell you is that he spent some time in Eretz Yisrael, volunteered in a kibbutz, so at least he was mekayim holech dalar amot beretz Yisrael, muftach lo shu ben olam haba. So at least he's got that to his name. Deserves our vote, right? No, I'm not politicking here. There are plenty, very well, plenty of Jews. I call them the Woody Allen Jews. The second Rebbe of Gur, so he explained that in the Aseret HaDibrot, It says, "Osa chesed la'alafim." Kadosh Baruch Hu will benefit thousand generations. Thousand generations is going to come out of you. Wow. And then with regard to the Avera, it says, "Shileshim ribeim l'sonai." 4 or 5 generations. Rebbe said this is not fair. It's totally imbalanced. He said, because there's certain Averot, there's no 5th generation to talk to. They're just out of the pale. They've assimilated totally into marriage. Nobody to talk to anymore. So that's 4 or 5 generations. When you go back to the migration of German Jewry in the 19th century to the United States, the beginning of the 19th century, I'm not talking about the Eastern European migration of 1880s, which brought at least 1 million Polish and Russian Jews to the United States, and many were Shomrei Torah Mitzvot, at least when they got to America. What happened afterwards is a different story. But I'm talking about German Jews, late 18th century, beginning of 19th century, who set up wonderful institutions of chesed, the hospitals, the Mount Sinai Hospital and others, and set up great stores like Levi Strauss and Macy's and the Sulzberger family from the New York Times. This is all from that migration. Do you have any idea how many great-grandchildren Jewish are from any of the families I just mentioned? Zero. Zero! You know, your zero is on a bottle of Coca-Cola also, but it means something else. But here it's zero. Zero Jews. What happened? Not one Jew coming out of these families? A lot of dungarees, a lot of jeans. That's what you have. But no Jews. It's very sad. Very, very sad. But this is what the Rebbe said. This is Al Shileshim V'Aribim. 4 or 5 generations. That's it. Finished. Sometimes after the 3rd generation, it's through. This is V'Nichvita HaNefesh Ahi Me'ameha. You cut off. You sever your ties from the people. And we've always had this. When you talk about the Spanish Jewry. So Spanish Jewry took a tremendous, tremendous fall in the late 15th century, the days of the Inquisition. Not because of the Gerush, and not because of the executions for those who didn't want to accept Christianity. Because those who did accept Christianity, and I'm not talking about the Maranos, 60% of Spanish Jewry go Catholic. Catholic, finished. Write them off. Completely. 60%. It's a phenomenal number. This has happened. So a Jew can...
It seems, with every statement,
huh?
It's contrary to what all the
leading apparently the Rebbe felt that it was a lost cause. The Rebbe felt it's hard, right? You figure the last people in the world you would have thought that, right? The
Mabcha Rebbe. They worked very hard to bring the Jews back.
Absolutely, but depends which Jews you're talking about. They'll go to the campuses and they'll try to work on students, university students, who are not they're not off the cliff yet. They may be on top of the cliff, ready to jump, but they're not off the cliff yet. You know, they might be dangling with intermarriage at the time, but they're not there yet. They have to work with them, no doubt. Rebbe was talking about people who intimating that there was this large number of people who just weren't there. So the Rebbe felt that this v'nichvita nefesh ahi me'ameha, as strange as this may sound, applied to Moshe Rabbeinu. He himself decreed karet. He severed himself from the people. Severed himself from the people. Now, how does the Rav know this? And how does that express itself? And how does Moshe Rabbeinu come back from this status of being severed from the people? You know, we talk about Avraham Avinu. How old was Avraham Avinu? He lives till 175. You want to write his biography? So you take the Chumash, and where does it start? So you know that Terach was his father, so he was born sometime, but nothing more than that. When does the scene open up on Avraham Avinu? How old is he? He's 70 years old already. He's 70 years old already when the scene opens up. So there, this question of 70 and 75. What came first, the Brit Ben Abtarim? Because there it seems that he was 70 over there, maybe 75 Balech Lecha. The question is, what came first? Is a question of Ein Mukdam and Mukhar. So from 870, we start getting a glimpse about something about very important about Avraham Avinu. And next thing you know, he's 99 years old. Like there's a little bit of a blackout. And now he's 100 years old. And then we don't know much about Avraham Avinu. We know that Sarah dies, and she's 127. So now Avraham Avinu, at 137, is involved with purchasing the Marat HaMachpelah. Fine. He goes on to live till 175. There's just a mere mentioning that he has another wife, Keturah, who might be Hagar, according to one opinion. You may have taken her back. We don't know. But whatever, he has another wife. That's it. That's it. What else do we know about Avraham Avinu? What did he do? Nothing else? Avraham Avinu, the curtain closes at 137. He's 137. So the Rav said, we're not interested in Mr. Avraham Avinu, the person who's in the phone book. We're interested in Avraham Avinu, who's the first of our forefathers, with Sarah Imenu. It's hyphenated. It's Avraham v'Sarah. So when Sarah dies, Avraham Avinu goes off the stage. He goes back to being a private person. Let me just give a, what we call lahavdil. What does an ex-president do? He makes money, right? He campaigns for his wife. Right. He writes his book. Becomes a great lecturer. Right? We go on the lecture tour. People don't understand why the Soviet Union collapsed in 1989. They can't understand it. Ah, the Soviet Union was Gorbachev and everything. It's very simple. Very simple. You see, Gorbachev, as president of the Soviet Union, was earning $300,000 a month salary. Somebody told him, you know, why don't you just collapse the whole thing and you'll be ex-president. Ex-president, you're going to get $50,000 a speech. So it's a wonderful idea. An ex-president is a popular person. But sometimes they don't know what to do with themselves. We have here too, people in politics for a long time, they retreat to oblivion. What's David Levy doing today? I don't know. I mean, he's in Beit Shan somewhere. Of course, people want to know what he did when he was in his prime, but that's a different story. But he was a very central figure, political figure for a certain time. People rise to stardom at some age. This is one of the problems of electing a young president of the United States. You go on to live another 40 years. What do you do?
Is that Hester Panim?
Hester Panim, that's also a Hester Panim of sorts, where you go into oblivion. But the Rav said, the reason why we don't know anything about Avraham Avinu until age 70, and nothing after age 137, because they do not impact on Am Yisrael. The only thing we know about Avraham Avinu is that which will impact on the future of Am Yisrael, the setting up of Am Yisrael, the future destiny of Am Yisrael. So it's the Brit Ben Abtarim, it's the wars, it's this, it's that. That's what's important. The purchasing of the Marat HaMachpelah has enormous impact on the future of Am Yisrael. The Akedah, this is what you know about Avraham Avinu. But, you know, what he ate for breakfast, what's the difference? What's the difference, right? Today you have these Gdolim books, you know, you have to know what he ate for breakfast. Who cares what he ate for breakfast? Right? It's ridiculous. They're printing things today that are absolutely ridiculous. But Avraham Avinu, this is what we know about him. What do we know about Yitzchak from personal biography? Very, very little. Very little. He's almost, I call him the sandwich between Avraham and Yaakov. Because biographically, we know very little about Yitzchak. Yaakov, we know a little bit more. But again, it's not a full picture. It's not a total composite. It's sketchy. But whatever we know about Yaakov Avinu impacts on Klal Yisrael. So we never deal with the years that we don't know about them, although occasionally in the Medrash, we have some filler material. Avraham Avinu was 3 years old when he recognized there's got to be a God in this world. Some say he was 40 years old. And the other Midrashic stories of Avraham Avinu, Beseda, this is an attempt to fill in some of the gaps with something about the background of Avraham Avinu, why a Kadosh Baruch Hu ultimately turns to Avraham Avinu. So here is a great verse from the Ger Rebbe. Why was it that a Kadosh Baruch Hu tells Avraham Avinu Lech Lecha? Why was it? What did he do right that he gets the? Or maybe some people would say, what did he do wrong? It's like when the Gabbai in the morning points to me that I should be the Shliach Tzibur. My first reaction is Machatati. What did I do wrong? Why am I in punishment and I'm the Onesh? You know, I have to be the Chazan for Rosh Chodesh. Long davening. So why is it? So the Ger Rebbe says, not that a Kadosh Baruch Hu turned to Avraham Avinu. Kadosh Baruch Hu turned to everyone and said, Lech Lecha. But Avraham was the only one who listened and paid attention. And believe me, I feel this every time I speak to Achenu B'nei Yisrael Bagola, like next week in Teaneck, New Jersey. I'll be here for the Shir Wednesday, don't worry. And I'll be here the week after Wednesday. But Bain LeBain, I'll be in Teaneck, New Jersey. And you can yell Lech Lecha, and from a whole community, you're going to have two people listening. That's good enough. That's worth it already. Let two people listen. Let people who are sitting on the fence and they need a little bit of a nudge in the right direction hear it from somebody in Eretz Yisrael. It's already worth it. I don't live in what's called delusions. Bring back the whole chutzlar, etc. So it's not going to happen. But you have to impact. You don't know who being inspired. You have to say it to everybody. But that's why Kadosh Baruch Hu said it to everybody. Avraham Avinu raised his hand. I heard. The only one who heard it. It's a tremendous idea from the Sfat Emet, from the Ger Rebbe. But here the Rav said, we don't know about Moshe Rabbeinu many, many years. So we can just write it off and say, Moshe Rabbeinu was born, he's 3 months old. When the scene opens up, he's born, Bayar Ki Tovu. Now he's 3 months old, and they put him in the basket on the swamp, and Bat Paroi picks him up, and the next thing we know, he's being raised in the house of Paroi, and then when he grows up, Vayigdala Ayelet. And how old is he? Maybe 12, 13. When he goes out to Vayar B'Sivlotam, right? Let's take a look. So it's number two. Vayi Vayimim Mehem, Vayidal Moshe, Vayetzei Alecha, Vayar B'Sivlotam. So obviously he was told by his biological parents who he is, even though he's being raised in the house of Paroi. So the parents had visitation rights. Parents could see him. There was no issue there. But Paroi didn't box out Yocheved and Amram from paying regular visits. But he was being raised in a foster home. In a foster home. Where Bat Paroi was the mother. And he was being treated royally. Literally, in every sense of the word. Figuratively and literally. Vayar, and he goes and he sees, Vayar ish mitzri makeh ish ivri me'echav. Me'echav! He knows that he's one of them. He knows it. Vayif ha'ko v'chol v'yar ke enish v'yachet ha'mitzri v'yit b'nei b'chol. He knocks the mitzri off. Buries him. Next day he goes out. So last week we dealt with this. Datan va'aviram syndrome, who they were. Why are you hitting your friend? Who appointed you, big judge? You want to kill one of us too? Like you killed the Mitzri yesterday? Moshe Rabbeinu went into a fright. I mean, he looked each way, nobody was looking, and today was already the headlines, everybody knew. The word's out. Story, this particular section ends, and Moshe Rabbeinu is already out of the picture. When does the curtain open up again on Moshe Rabbeinu? He gets to Midian. Does he get to Midian immediately after he flees Mitzrayim? That's what seems to indicate. He ran away from Paroi, and he gets to Midian, Vayeshev al ha-Be'er, and the story of meeting the daughters of Yitro occurs, and he's taken into the household. He marries Tzipora, has a child, Gershom, Ger Hayiti Be'eretz Nochriya. Means he feels displaced, no doubt. He feels displaced from his family. But the next thing we know, Moshe Rabbeinu is at the Sneh. How old is Moshe Rabbeinu at the Sneh? He's 80 years old. What happened, Bain LeBain? That's at least 60 years, maybe a little bit more, but at least 60 years pass. And we don't have a clue. What's Moshe Rabbeinu doing? What's he doing? He's tending the sheep of Yitro. That's what he does, day in and day out. How boring. But you want to know something? It might not be that boring. It might sound boring. But it's not an accident that the great Nevi'ei Yisrael, the great prophets, were shepherds. You know why? Because you have a lot of time to sit and think. You need time to think. But I'm not a prophet. And I'm not Yirmiyahu, not Yaakov Avinu, not Moshe Rabbeinu. And I'm also not a shepherd. But I happen to appreciate just sitting and thinking on airplanes. That's why I make long flights without taking a book. What?
You're thinking of being a pilot.
No. I think of other things. It's a time for thinking. I remember when I was in the years I was scooting back and forth to Zurich, so on Fridays, this gorgeous lake. Why the Rabban Shem gave that nation of anti-Semites such a beautiful country? One day I hope to find out. It's absolutely beautiful, mamish, beautiful country, the Alps. So much so that Rav Shamshon Rafal Hirsch, when he was old already in Frankfurt, he asked somebody to take him up to the Alps. Now, at this age, I have to go up to the Alps. Obviously, he's not going skiing. I mean, what are you doing in the Alps? He says, Rabban Shem is going to ask me, you live so close to my Alps. No, what do you think of my Alps? Well, I'm going to say I wasn't there. So they wanted to go to the Alps, to see the Alps. It is beautiful. But in this lake, they're river boats. They're like lake boats. Yeah. Whatever it is, you get it cheap when you buy the public transportation. You get it. Part of it. That's why I did it. So you sit on the boat for an hour and a half, and you write a drasha. I used to write my drashas on the boat. Shabbos HaGola drasha I once wrote on the boat. And the truth is, I didn't have Svarim with me. I mean, I didn't have this, which today would have helped me a little bit more. But you vaguely remember sources. The sources you look up afterwards. What you're looking for is not so much to write the drasha, more for the inspiration. What exactly do you want to say? And what's the angle you're going to use to say it? After you have that, that's 90% of the drasha. After that, it's just filler material. You know you have to get up there and ploy there for an hour and a quarter, as my wife will say. Got to ploy there for an hour and a quarter. So you got to fill it up with material. So you throw in a few Rambams, you throw through this, a few Reb Chaims, and then you make it into a schmaltz it up. But what are you saying? What you want to say, you can say in 3 minutes. You have an idea. Of course, you want to bring it out dramatically. You want to amplify it. You want to give it some basis. That's what makes the drasha. You give it body. You have to give it body, no doubt. But the place, you have to have calm. You have to have calm. That's why I can tell you, I'll give away my trade secrets. The drashot that I write in Vahol Nechama is at 4 in the morning on Thursday night. No phone calls. No messages. Quiet. Sometimes there's a Yankee game on. That gives inspiration. You have to have inspiration. You have to have a moment of mamish tranquility, sea of tranquility. Maybe that's why I wanted to be an astronaut. Go to the moon, to the sea of tranquility. Ah, there you can write a drasha. Sea of tranquility is the lake in Zurich. That was a sea of tranquility. Mamish. Nobody's bothering you. I mean, there are other people on the boat, so nobody's bothering you. Nobody's looking at you. Just sit, think. Ah, beautiful weather. It's really something. That's what the Nevi'ei Yisrael were doing when they were tending the sheep. Because you have to cultivate your thinking ability, your ability to imagine. The Rambam says imagination is a key tool in achieving prophecy. So you have to fantasize. You have to really work on your imagination and your thoughts and what you want to do. And you will things into reality. You ultimately can will things into reality. Moshe Rabbeinu was 60 years a shepherd. And the Rav wants to know, what can we learn from the absence of Moshe Rabbeinu in the Torah for over 60 years? What can we learn? And his suggestion is that unlike with regard to Avraham Avinu, we don't know. Because what's important is what it says in the text, and that's important for the future of Klal Yisrael. The Rav said what we don't know about Moshe Rabbeinu is no less important than what it does say about Moshe Rabbeinu. These 60 years are hester panim. Moshe Rabbeinu has severed himself from the people. Severed himself. So much so that the Medrash says, and I said this already a few weeks ago, we talked about Yosef and his desire to be buried in Eretz Canaan, in Eretz Yisrael, no different than his father Yaakov. So the Medrash says, Moshe Rabbeinu was begging to go into Eretz Yisrael. So Kadosh Baruch Hu said no. For whatever reason, Kadosh Baruch Hu said no. Why did it not happen that they would take Moshe Rabbeinu to be buried in Eretz Yisrael? Why did that not happen? And Moshe Rabbeinu was buried in a place where lo noda makom kfurato. Nobody knows. You can't make it into a Baba Sali or a Chayzer Milublin or whatever. You can't go to his burial site and put kvidlach. There was no. That's they didn't want. Rosh Hashanah, Kadosh Baruch Hu didn't want that his burial site should become a center of attraction. Lo noda makom kruato, ari yom hazeh. But why couldn't he be buried in Eretz Yisrael? So the Medrash says, because when Yosef identifies himself, he says he's an Ish Ivri. And Moshe identifies himself as an Ish Mitzri to the daughters of Yitro. Who are you? Are you? Remember I told you about the difference between American Jews and Jewish Americans. Who are you? Your identity. And Moshe Rabbeinu saw himself as a Mitzri. Ah, you're a Mitzri? You can stay in Chutz Laaretz, even in burial. It's very sad comment on the Moshe Rabbeinu, with all his greatness, that he was somehow willingly separated from the people. Willingly. When he says that he ran away, so number one, the Rav pointed out that in source number 6 in the Ramban, maybe next week we'll read it a little bit more carefully, or just summarize, that he doesn't get to Midian right away. The way the Ramban explains that last pasuk of source number 2, Vayivrach Moshe mipnei Paro, Vayeshev be'eretz Midian, Vayeshev ala be'er, doesn't mean that he runs from Paro, flees from Paro, from Mitzrayim, and his next station is Midian, and the scene opens up there at the Be'er, at the well, with the daughters of Yitro. No. No. Ramban says Moshe Rabbeinu was a wanderer because he was a fugitive. You think Paroi didn't send out henchmen to try to track him down? He was a wanted man. Like in the days of the Wild West and all the Cowboys and Indians movies. A wanted man. Nobody ever thinks that. Nobody even thinks for a moment. Till Ramban suggests that's what happened. And ultimately, he shakes off, you know, sometimes the hunt. And they call off the hunt. After a few years, they call off the hunt. And he's here, and he's there, and he tries to cover his tracks so they shouldn't find him. And he ends up in Midian. That's his last station. Of Vayisu Vayachnu, Vayisu Vayachnu, Vayisu Vayachnu. Almost like Bnei Yisrael in the Midbar. It's going from place to place, place to place, place to place. And he ends up in Midian. But unlike, if you take a look at source number 4, Vayetzav Otam Lemor, Kotomrun La'adoni Le'esav, Ko Amar Abdecha Yaakov, Im Lavan Garti Va'echar Erata. In Parshat Vayishlach, Yaakov Avinu sends a delegation to Esav, and he reports, in Lavan Garti, I lived by Lavan for 20 years. What does the word Garti mean? Does the word Garti suggest permanent residence or temporary residence? What's your guess?
Ger.
What does Ger mean? Stranger. Stranger. Avram Avinu makes the comment, Ger v'toshav anochi imachem. On the one hand, I'm a strange, I'm a misfit here. On the other hand, it's mine. I don't care if I'm a misfit, but this is my land. So I'm a toshav. And the Rav said, in the context of a drasha, the Jew has always been a ger v'toshav. He struggles to be part and parcel of society, and he's always a misfit. Somebody sticks out. As the Haftarah in Parshat Kedoshim, from Sefer Amos, Vatem kivnei kushiyim, kushiyim atem li. Kushiyim, kushi is a black person from Ethiopia. So the Rav said, if you have 100 people in the room and one person is a black person, the person stands out. You can see right away where he is. That's the way it is. If you have 100 people in the room, 99 not Jewish and one Jew, you can pick him out right away. By his nose, of course. You can pick out the Jew right away. Halo kivnei kushiyim atem li. Ger v'toshav anochi. When Yaakov Avinu says, Im Lavan Garti, I resided there, but it was temporary existence at day 1 and at day 20, year 20. It was temporary. As opposed to Toshav, Vayeshev Be'eretz Midyan, Vayeshev Ala Be'er. The Rav says, why does it say twice Vayeshev? To indicate that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't plan on being there temporarily, but he parked himself permanently. He severed his ties from his people. A yeshev al haber. And to this end, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to have to work very hard to try to bring Moshe Rabbeinu back into the fold, to sensitize him, first of all, that he is not a Midianite, but he's part of Bnei Yisrael. And not only is part of Bnei Yisrael, but he is going to be the one who is going to bring Am Yisrael back. Which means that Moshe Rabbeinu, on a personal level, is going to take the root of Am Yisrael to become sensitive once again to the Brit of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, and only then will there be a chance for Geula. And if you, Moshe, can succeed on a personal level and appreciate that journey back to becoming a member of Klal Yisrael, you are going to be able to convince them, the Avadim, that they'll be able to do it as well. And only on that basis would Moshe be ready to perform this task of being the messenger of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. We're going to continue with this page next week, because we're not through yet, and I'll prepare some more material as well. So if you just want to put the page back on the table, on the chair there, I will take it home and bring it mitzvah next week. If you want to take it home, gesund to hate, but try to remember to bring it next week, because I don't have to make more copies. Okay.
I just wanted to tell you.